barred from checking a citation because no women were allowed in that reading room. RBG begged the guard to let her stand at the door while he grabbed the journal for her, but he wouldn't budge. The annual banquet was a perk of being on Law Review, but RBG wasn't allowed to bring her beloved mother-in-law to it, and the men weren't allowed to take their wives, because even though there were female members, it was still a boys' club. Women were barred from living in the dorms, the exact opposite policy from Cornell, and neither role made sense to RBG. There was no women's bathroom in the main building, where exams were held. After that first year, a classmate named Rhoda Isselbacher, who was pregnant during the exam period, informed the men she would use their bathroom whether they liked it or not. RBG didn't think to complain. She was lucky, in a way. Harvard had said she had to submit her husband's father's financials now that she was married, so her father-in-law, Morris, had agreed to pay her tuition. Some of her classmates worried that going to law school would ruin their chances of marriage, or that their husbands would tire of having wives with plans. But RBG had a husband who bragged that his wife had done better than him. He teased her only about her driving, and even RBG admitted she was a terrible driver. By their second year in Cambridge, in 1957, RBG had worked out a kind of rhythm. Classes and studying until 4 p.m., then home to relieve the babysitter, a New England grandmotherly type. Her hours with Jane before bed helped leaven the library time. Marty was realizing his lifelong passion for the tax code. Then the doctor found the tumor in his testicle. Cancer, which had already stolen her mother, threatened to take Marty too. The doctor prescribed radical surgery and daily radiation for 6 weeks. The prognosis was grim. The last thing RBG was going to do was act like Marty was dying, so she threw everything into making sure he stayed on track in his studies, despite having missed all but 2 weeks of the semester. Who were the best note-takers in his classes? She handed them carbon paper and told them to pass on the class notes. Each night, she typed these notes up with the occasional help of a girlfriend of Marty's classmate. Marty was weak, but he came alive when his classmates came by and they could argue the finer points of corporate reorganization. Sometimes he woke at midnight, and that was the only time he could eat. Too ill to type, he would lie on the couch and dictate to his wife his paper on loss corporations. When Marty fell asleep around 2 a.m., RBG would begin her own work. That was how she learned she could get by on just 1 or 2 hours of sleep, as long as she could sleep in a little on weekends. Unable to think about a reality in which Marty had no future, RBG went to Dean Griswold and asked him if Marty's class standing could be based on his first 2 years. He would get whatever his grades would show, Griswold told her, and they would record that he had been sick. RBG went home and told her husband, "Do whatever you can do to pass. Only your first and second years will count." Asked 60 years later if this had been a white lie, RBG only said, "He was at ease for those exams." Marty made it through, against all odds, and graduated. He even found work as a tax attorney at a firm in New York. The young family was determined to stay together, and RBG found herself again at Dean Griswold's mercy. She had waited so long for her Harvard degree. If she took her third-year classes at Columbia in New York, could she still get one? They didn't know how long Marty would live. Couldn't they get a hardship exemption to the transfer policy? Again, Griswold refused. RBG showed up on the Columbia campus, too afraid to even ask whether the law school would grant her a degree. The handful of women at Columbia Law School didn't have it easy either. Hazel Gerber, whose son would one day be one of RBG's favorite clerks, once began a sentence in class with, "I feel..." and her law professor cut in, "Miss Gerber, women feel, men think." RBG's reputation preceded her. We had heard that the smartest person on the East Coast was going to transfer, and that we were all going to drop down one rank, classmate Nina Apple later told the New York Times. They were right to worry. RBG made the Law Review a second time and graduated tied for first in her class. Harvard Law's strict transfer rules stayed in place for decades. In the late 70s, as the policy came up for fresh scrutiny, Marty wrote a letter to the Harvard Law Record to complain of his family's ordeal. The editors published his letter, appending a note. As Mr. Ginsburg told us, the Ruth in the letter is Ruth Bader Ginsburg, professor of law at Columbia and general counsel of the American Civil Liberties Union. Just think what else she might have accomplished had she enjoyed the benefits of a Harvard degree. Lady is a four-letter word. One day in the 1959 term, Associate Justice Felix Frankfurter burst into his chambers and announced to his clerks that he had unbelievable news. Frankfurter held what was sometimes called the Jewish seat on the Supreme Court. He had a habit of having Harvard law professors pick his clerks. The young men who served as Supreme Court law clerks, and they had almost always been men, had the most elite entry-level jobs in the business, working closely with the justices to research and draft their opinions. The boys would never guess who Professor Al Sachs wanted to send Frankfurter that year, he told them. Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Paul Bender, a Frankfurter clerk who had known RBG since James Madison High School and through Harvard Law, ventured his support. Frankfurter protested that Ginsburg had a couple of kids and her husband has been ill, and you know that I work you guys very, very hard, and I do curse sometimes. Almost all of that was false. RBG had only one kid. Bender believed he and his compatriots had the softest job of all the law clerks at the court. There was more shading of the truth, Bender said. The justice did not use four-letter words. There is no remaining evidence that, as a much retold story has it, Frankfurter demanded to know if RBG wore pants, as he despised girls who wore pants. Frankfurter had never refused a recommended candidate, but when word reached RBG that she would not clerk on the Supreme Court, she was not surprised. She knew that Judge Learned Hand, a federal court of appeals judge she idolized, had a policy against hiring women because he was actually known to be potty-mouthed and didn't want to have to watch his language around women. She had gotten used to seeing sign-up sheets at Columbia for firm interviews that were labeled men only. RBG had worked at the law firm of Paul Weiss one summer, but it turned out the firm had already hired one woman that year, and one was enough for them. They hired Polly Murray, a black woman whose work would one day have an enormous impact on her. To her two interviews, RBG wore a black tailored suit that her mother-in-law had chosen for her. She got no offers. As RBG saw it, she had three strikes against her. She was a woman, the mother of a four-year-old, and a Jew. Gerald Gunther, a constitutional law professor at Columbia, was determined to find his brilliant student a spot, even if it involved blackmail. Federal Judge Edmund L. Palmieri of the Southern District of New York, a Columbia grad, always took Gunther's recommendation without question. But Palmieri was skeptical of Gunther's pick that year. Would she really be up to the job with a small child at home? Gunther promised that if it didn't work out, he would supply Palmieri with a male replacement. And if he didn't give this young lady a chance, Gunther swore he would never send Palmieri another clerk again. Whether carrot or stick, something worked. Palmieri did not send the young Mrs. Ginsburg home. She worked even harder than she probably needed to, coming in on weekends and taking work home. Palmieri later said she was one of his best clerks ever. As it happened, Judges Hand and Palmieri lived around the corner from each other, and Palmieri often gave both Hand and Ginsburg a ride home from the federal courthouse. The man would say or sing anything that came into his head, RBG remembered of Hand. I once asked, Judge Hand, in this car you speak freely. You say words my mother never taught me. I don't seem to be inhibiting you. He replied, Young lady, I'm not looking at you. When after 2 years clerking, the doors of corporate law firms tentatively swung open, RBG no longer wanted to walk through them. Instead, in 1961, she accepted an invitation for lunch at the Harvard Club with Hans Smit, a Dutchman she had met at Columbia. A few minutes after she'd walked through a small red side door where they begrudgingly let women in, Smit said, Ruth, how would you like to co-author a book about civil procedure in Sweden? He was putting together a comparative project at Columbia Law. Schmidt had no trouble finding men to go to France and Italy, but finding someone ready to become fluent in Swedish and then travel to Sweden to study the legal system was a taller order. RBG wasn't sure she could find Sweden on a map, but she knew how she felt about writing a book of her own. And though she only half realized it at the time, there was another reason she took Schmidt up on his offer. Jane was in first grade, RBG was nearing 30, and she had never lived alone or spent much time on her own at all. She wondered if she could cut it. Marty agreed to hold down the home front, and he and Jane would eventually come visit. At the airport in Stockholm, Swedish city judge Anders Berzelius, who had arrived to fetch her, walked right by her, expecting a much older woman. Nevertheless, RBG had arrived at the right time. In the post-war era, Swedish women had begun to enter the workforce in large numbers, more than American women had. They found their liberation to be partial. Journalist Eva Moberg spoke for many Swedish women when, in a 1961 essay, she demanded to know why women now had two jobs while men had one. Actually, there is no biological connection whatsoever between the function of giving birth to and nursing a child and the function of washing its clothes, preparing its food, and trying to bring it up to be a good and harmonious person, Moberg wrote. Both men and women have one main role, that of being human beings. In the summer of 1962, during one of RBG's trips, another American woman arrived in Sweden. Actress Sherry Finkbein had tried to get an abortion after taking the then-common sleep aid thalidomide, which doctors belatedly realized caused severe fetal disabilities. Abortion was still broadly illegal in the United States, and only Sweden opened its doors to Finkbein. When RBG wasn't immersing herself in the Swedish legal system, or watching Ingmar Bergman movies sans subtitles, she observed these debates in awe. Who knew another world was possible for women? One in which they could work, fight back at unfair conditions, end a pregnancy if they felt they needed to. One where the government, pushed by activists, had begun to take an active interest in freeing men and women from prescribed gender roles. It was a personal revolution for her, too. She found out in her first 6 weeks on her own that she could do just fine. Back in New York, Schmidt encouraged her to teach some civil procedure classes at Columbia and to overcome her shyness by speaking at international conferences. She and Berzelius published their book on Swedish civil procedure, later called the best English language book on the Swedish judicial system. True, at the time, it was the only one. She felt sure of herself, but there was too much going on to think about it much. It would be a few years before she realized just how much she had learned in Sweden. It would change her life. Chapter 4. Stereotypes of a Lady Misunderstood. So it was that 10 years of my life that I devoted to litigating cases about, I don't say women's rights, I say the constitutional principle of the equal citizenship stature of men and women. RBG, 2010. RBG had skipped lunch the morning of January 17, 1973. She was afraid she would vomit. Wearing her mother's pin and earrings, like a soldier suiting up for battle, RBG stood alone in front of 9 stone-faced men and asked them to do something they had until then refused to do, recognize that the Constitution banned sex discrimination. All oral arguments at the Supreme Court begin the same way. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. You can listen to the recording of RBG speaking these words, how at first they came out a little shakily. It was her first time arguing before the Court. To still the queasiness in her stomach, she had memorized the opening sentence. She told the justices about Sharon Frontiero, an Air Force lieutenant whose husband, Joseph, had been denied the same housing, medical, and dental benefits as other military spouses, simply because Sharon was a woman and Joseph was a man. 14 months earlier, the court had ruled on the case of an Idaho woman denied the right to administer her dead son's estate because she was a woman. The justices said, in Reed v. Reed, that the state couldn't automatically assume men were better equipped to handle an estate than women. But they had left unsettled the broader question of whether discriminating on the basis of sex was almost always unconstitutional. RBG took a deep breath and told the justices they had to finish the job they started. The state law in Reed, and the federal one she challenged that day in Frontiero v. Richardson, RBG argued, drew on the same stereotype. The man is or should be the independent partner in a marital unit. The woman, with an occasional exception, is dependent, sheltered from breadwinning experience. RBG usually looked for Marty in a room any time she had to speak in public, but this time she had to settle for knowing he was behind her, in the section reserved for lawyers admitted to argue before the Supreme Court. Suddenly, she felt the ground steady under her. These men, the most important judges in the country, were her captive audience for the next 10 minutes. RBG knew so much more about the case and the topic than they did. She had to teach them. She knew how to do that. RBG had been teaching law for almost a decade. Mrs. Ruth Ginsburg, read the Supreme Court bar admissions card she had been handed in the court that day. RBG had gone by Ms. since there had been a Ms. The students in her Columbia seminar who had come along that day grimaced and wanted her to demand a change. She would not. RBG was there to win, not to rock the boat when it wasn't strictly necessary. Her argument was radical enough. These distinguished men of the court thought of themselves as good fathers and good husbands. Men and women were fundamentally different, they believed, and women were lucky to be spared the squalor and pressures of the real world. This little woman, not yet 40, had to make the justices see that women deserved the same standing in the world as men. Treating men and women differently under the law, RBG told the justices, implied a judgment of inferiority. It told women their work and their families were less valuable. These distinctions have a common effect, RBG said sternly. They help keep woman in her place, a place inferior to that occupied by men in our society. Behind her sat Brenda Feigen, who had co-founded the ACLU Women's Rights Project with her 1 year earlier. Feigen had casebooks open on the desk before her, ready to provide RBG with a citation if she needed it. But RBG didn't need it. She rattled off the page numbers and volumes as casually as if she was giving a friend her phone number. Her opponent that day was the federal government. In a brief, the government defended its policy of assuming women were dependents and allowing only a narrow pool of men to apply for dependent benefits. After all, most breadwinners were men. On the first page of that brief was the name of Irwin Griswold, RBG's old Harvard Law Dean, now the nation's Solicitor General. She'd come a long way from telling Dean Griswold she'd gone to law school to make better wifely chit-chat with Marty. The justices still hadn't said a word. RBG continued, "Sex, like race, is a visible, immutable characteristic bearing no necessary relationship to ability." The analogy had special meaning in the constitutional context. In a series of cases triggered by Brown v. Board of Education, the court had said that laws that classified on the basis of race were almost always unconstitutional, or deserving strict scrutiny. The court had said in Reed that it wasn't applying strict scrutiny, but then it seemed to do so anyway. Were laws that classified what men and women could do blatantly unconstitutional, the way laws classifying by race were? RBG boldly urged the court to say they were. Her time was almost up. RBG looked the justices in the eye and quoted Sarah Grimke, the abolitionist and advocate for women's suffrage. She spoke not elegantly, but with unmistakable clarity, RBG said. She said, "I ask no favor for my sex. All I ask of our brethren is that they take their feet off our necks." Lawyers arguing at the Supreme Court sometimes have trouble getting out a full sentence. That January day, on an empty stomach and with Brooklyn vowels still in her voice, RBG spoke for 10 minutes without a single interruption from the justices. She had stunned them into silence. Underneath her composure, RBG was trembling. Were the justices even listening? She would have to wait 5 months to find out. As the crowd filed out after the argument, a stocky figure approached RBG. It was Dean Griswold, who had been watching one of his men argue against RBG and the other lawyer representing Frontiero. Solemnly, Griswold shook RBG's hand. That night, Justice Harry Blackmun, who in his diary graded lawyers on their performance before the court, gave her only a C+. "Very precise female," Blackmun wrote. Land, like woman, was meant to be possessed. 10 years earlier, in 1963, RBG picked fewer battles. She had read and been awed by Simone de Beauvoir's The Second Sex. Like most of the things she learned in Sweden that were not civil procedure, she shelved it. A professor at Columbia, where she had begun lecturing, said he'd heard Rutgers School of Law was looking for a woman. After all, their only black professor had just moved on. No one seemed concerned that Columbia's law school had no female or black full-time faculty. Only 14 women in the entire country had tenure-track positions at law schools, and Rutgers already had one of them. RBG and fellow Rutgers law professor Eva Hanks would soon be profiled in the Newark Star-Ledger under the headline, "Robes for Two Ladies." The story led with calling them slim, attractive, and gushed, "From their youthful appearance, they could easily be taken for students." In her first year, Rutgers offered RBG an annual contract to teach civil procedure. The salary was low. After all, Dean Willard Heckel reminded her, it was a state school, and she was a woman. "They told me, 'We can't pay you as much as A, who has 5 children. You have a husband who earns a good salary,'" RBG remembered, discreetly withholding names. "I asked if B, a bachelor, was also paid more, and was told yes." That was the end of that conversation. RBG kept her head down, taking the train each day to Newark from Manhattan's Penn Station, and publishing articles with titles like "Recognition and Execution of Foreign Civil Judgments and Arbitration Awards." She made it to a second year. Then came a surprise. After Marty's surgery, but before his radiation for testicular cancer, the doctor had informed the couple they had a quick and final window to try for a second child. Those were the days of juggling law school and a toddler and not knowing how long Marty would live. Another child was something they couldn't imagine. By the time Jane was nearly 10 years old, her parents had just about convinced her that being an only child wasn't such a bad thing. But early in 1965, RBG discovered she was pregnant. "Tell me, dear," said the female doctor, taking RBG's hand, "is there another?" There was no other. They ran a test and confirmed that Marty was still able to produce sperm. RBG's joy at the news of her pregnancy was tangled up in anxiety about her job. Rutgers would decide on her contract renewal at the end of the spring semester, and RBG wasn't about to repeat the mistake she had made at the Social Security office in Oklahoma. She ran to her mother-in-law's closet. Evelyn Ginsburg wore one size larger, and with a due date in September, RBG might only begin showing during the summer vacation. It worked. RBG waited until the last day of classes, with the next year's contract in her hand, to break the news to her fellow professors. James was born September 8th. Professor Ginsburg was soon back before her students as if nothing had changed. But some things had changed. One of her law students declared himself a member of the free speech movement. Each day, just before class, he climbed up on a branch, perched himself there, then thumbed his nose at me intermittently, RBG recalled. In her first classes at Rutgers, there had been maybe 5 or 6 women on every seating chart. As more men suited up for Vietnam, more women filled law school seats. Outside the classroom, the feminine mystique, chronicling the discontent of educated middle-class women with their domestic roles, had sold over 1 million copies in its first paperback printing. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 had almost by accident banned employment discrimination on the basis of sex alongside race, despite many ball-and-chain jokes from congressmen. Representative Emanuel Seller joked that he usually had the last word in his house. Yes, dear. The New Jersey branch of the American Civil Liberties Union, where RBG had signed up as a volunteer lawyer, was overwhelmed by letters from women. She was a woman, RBG was told. Couldn't she handle it? She dutifully took a look. A woman who worked at Lipton Tea was barred from adding her family to her health insurance plan, because the company assumed only married men had dependents. Girls weren't welcome in Princeton's summer engineering program. The best tennis player in Teaneck, New Jersey, wasn't allowed on the varsity team because she was a girl. Some letters gave RBG the embarrassed flush of recognition. Teachers complained that they were forced off the job the moment they started showing pregnancy, and sometimes before. The schools called it maternity leave, but it wasn't voluntary or paid, and the teachers couldn't get their jobs back unless the school felt like it. One military woman had received an honorable discharge for being pregnant, but when she tried to re-enlist, she learned pregnancy was a moral and administrative disqualification. None of these problems were new. What was new was that anyone thought it was worth it to complain about it. RBG certainly hadn't. The new crop of female law students, a decade or so younger than her, did more than complain. They made demands. Some of them were fresh from Mississippi, working for civil rights with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. These women had seen lawyers help lead the way, only to come to law schools and find that ladies were expected to fall in line. The universities themselves began to grudgingly make more space for women, especially after 1968, when the Johnson administration added sex discrimination to the list of sins that would imperil federal funding. RBG watched these female students with some awe. How different they were from her generation, who'd been terrified of making a splash. When a handful of students came to RBG in 1970 and asked her to teach the first-ever Rutgers class on women and the law, she was ready to agree. It took her only about a month to read every federal decision and every law review article about women's status. There wasn't much. One popular textbook included the passage, "Land, like woman, was meant to be possessed." The book was about land ownership. Women were just the analogy. When she left the library, RBG knew this much. Her days of quiet acceptance were over. That included accepting Rutgers as giving her the ladies' discount. RBG helped the other female professors file a federal class action pay discrimination claim against the university. They won. Plucking herself out of obscurity. On August 20th, 1971, a female letter carrier in Springfield, New Jersey, wrote to the New Jersey chapter of the ACLU to complain that she wasn't allowed to wear the same hat that men wore. The female carrier hats, a beret or a pillbox, have no place on which to attach my badge, Lainey Kaplan explained in her letter. The male carrier hat has a brim to keep the sun from your eyes, which the female carrier hats have none. RBG was getting ready to lecture at Harvard Law School for the semester. She had begun bringing cases to the Supreme Court, but no case was too small. The insistence on sexual identification by headgear for female letter carriers at the expense of functional features that would facilitate job performance appears to be wholly arbitrary, RBG wrote the Postmaster General. The man may not have known what hit him. It was clear to RBG that fighting discrimination one strongly worded letter at a time was like catching the ocean in a thimble. There would always be another sexist law or regulation to take down. Women's rights advocates needed to think bigger. What the country needed was a broader recognition of gender equality, whether in headgear or federal policy. For decades, some feminists had said the solution was an equal rights amendment to the Constitution, which would read, "Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States, or by any state, on account of sex." This amendment, known as the ERA, had been introduced in every session of Congress since 1923, but each time it had been held up in committee. RBG wondered whether the Constitution already held the answer. Its preamble began with, "We the people," and women were people, even if they had been long prevented from living out their full destinies. Didn't women deserve equal protection under the law, as the 14th Amendment promised? The question was how to get at least 5 Supreme Court justices to see the Constitution as she did. By the early 70s, women's roles had fundamentally transformed almost everywhere but in the high court's chambers. Maybe, given the right case, the justices would come around. RBG was puzzling over her strategy one night, working, as she usually did, in the bedroom. "There's something you've got to read," Marty exclaimed from the dining room where he was working. "I don't read tax cases," RBG replied. She would be glad she read that one. Charles E. Moritz was a traveling salesman who lived with his 89-year-old mother in Denver. Moritz paid someone to care for her when he was on the road, but his troubles began when he tried to take a tax deduction. The IRS only granted such deductions to women, widowers, or the husbands of incapacitated women, and Moritz was a never-married man. The idea that a man on his own might be responsible somehow for caregiving apparently never crossed the government's mind. With a wide grin, RBG said, "Let's take it." It was her and Marty's first professional partnership. On the surface, the Moritz case was more small ball. He had been denied no more than $600 in expenses. There was no apparent glaring injustice to women. Marty and RBG could see beyond that. The government was senselessly denying a benefit to someone purely on the basis of gender. If the court said that was wrong, the precedent set would open the door to a broader recognition of gender equality. RBG wrote to Mel Wolf, an old friend from summer camp who had become the national legal director for the ACLU, seeking support. Wolf agreed to back them. He later told author Fred Strebe that he knew that RBG was doing some down-and-dirty women's rights work out in New Jersey. Wolf was about to pluck her from obscurity, he bragged to Strebe. He would help her get to the Supreme Court. In their brief, the Ginsburgs argued that the government couldn't discriminate between men and women when biological differences are not related to the activities in question. RBG sent their work to Wolf. She knew the ACLU had taken on the Supreme Court appeal of an Idaho law that preferred men over women to be administrators of estates. Sally Reed's husband had been abusive and left the family, but when their son killed himself, it was Cecil Reed who would officially carry on what little material possessions the son had left behind, just because Cecil was a man. That was what the law said. RBG believed the Moritz case, paired with Reed, could show that gender discrimination harmed everybody. "Some of this should be useful for Reed v. Reed," she wrote Wolf on April 6, 1971, attaching the Moritz brief. "Have you thought about whether it would be appropriate to have a woman co-counsel in that case?" RBG had rarely asked anyone to consider her because she was a woman, but getting to the Supreme Court was worth it. Thinking it over years later, Wolf told Strebe, "Damn, maybe I didn't pluck her from obscurity. Maybe she plucked herself from obscurity." He was right. Wolf told RBG he could use her help building Sally Reed's case to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court never saw a sex classification it didn't like. The Reed case had high stakes. If the Supreme Court wasn't ready to overturn its precedents that allowed the law to treat women as second-class citizens, Reed might lead it to double down on bad law. Only 10 years prior, in 1961, a woman named Gwendolyn Hoyt, tried for murdering her husband, had challenged the all-male jury that convicted her. In Florida, men were obliged to serve on juries, but women had to opt in. It was perfectly fine to treat women's participation as an afterthought, the justices said, because women were still regarded as the center of home and family life. The Hoyt case made plain that the court hadn't progressed much since the 1948 opinion in which Felix Frankfurter, the same justice who refused to hire RBG as a clerk, gravely acknowledged that letting women freely bartend could give rise to moral and social problems. Back in law school, in her summer working at Paul Weiss, RBG had met a lawyer named Polly Murray. She was a black woman at a time when race and gender were largely seen as separate categories. Murray worked passionately to build bridges between the civil rights movement, which she critiqued for being male-dominated, and women's rights activists, many of whom had serious blind spots on race. It turned out that even though RBG was asking the court to venture somewhere it had never gone, Murray had taken the first steps. Murray had been arguing as early as 1961 that the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment might on its own free women of legal constraints. With fellow ACLU attorney Dorothy Kenyon, Murray tried to find a way to overturn the Hoyt precedent. Jane Crow and the Law, a 1965 article Murray co-authored comparing racial and gendered oppression, was on RBG's Rutgers syllabus. The year after that article was published, Murray and Kenyon had tried to put their theories of the parallels and intersections of race and gender into practice. They challenged the all-white and all-male jury in Alabama that acquitted the murderers of two voting rights activists. They won, but Alabama never appealed to the Supreme Court, so the story ended there. Murray's work was all over RBG's soon-to-be-famous Reed brief, which also included unusual references to Simone de Beauvoir, the poet Alfred Lord Tennyson, and the sociologist Gunnar Myrdal. Written with the help of RBG's feminist law students, the brief pointed out that while the world had changed, the law was stuck in the old ways. Before she submitted the Reed brief to the Supreme Court, RBG added two more names to the cover, where the authors' names went, Dorothy Kenyon and Polly Murray. She wanted to make it clear that she was standing on their shoulders, RBG later said. It's just not done, Bert Newborn, then a colleague at the ACLU, remembers telling her. He called it a violation of the canons. I don't care, RBG replied. They deserve recognition. Later, she would say her work was carrying on what Kenyon and Murray had pioneered. It was just that the world was finally ready to listen. From RBG's brief in Reed v. Reed. For additional commentary, please see the enhanced portion of this audiobook. The sex line, drawn by Section 15-314, mandating subordination of women to men without regard to individual capacity, creates a suspect classification, requiring close judicial scrutiny. Although the legislature may distinguish between individuals on the basis of their need or ability, it is presumptively impermissible to distinguish on the basis of an unalterable identifying trait over which the individual has no control and for which he or she should not be disadvantaged by the law. Legislative discrimination grounded on sex, for purposes unrelated to any biological difference between the sexes, ranks with legislative discrimination based on race, another congenital, unalterable trait of birth, and merits no greater judicial deference. The distance to equal opportunity for women in the United States remains considerable in face of the pervasive social, cultural, and legal roots of sex-based discrimination. As other groups that have been assisted toward full equality before the law via the suspect classification doctrine, women are sparsely represented in legislative and policy-making chambers and lack political power to remedy the discriminatory treatment they are accorded in the law and in society generally. Absent firm constitutional foundation for equal treatment of men and women by the law, women seeking to be judged on their individual merits will continue to encounter law-sanctioned obstacles. Prior decisions of this court have contributed to the separate and unequal status of women in the United States. But the national consciousness has been awakened to the sometimes subtle assignment of inferior status to women by the dominant male culture. The time is ripe for this court to repudiate the premise that, with minimal justification, the legislature may draw a sharp line between the sexes, just as this court has repudiated once settled law that differential treatment of the races is constitutionally permissible. Biological differences between the sexes bear no relationship to the duties performed by an administrator. Idaho's interest in administrative convenience, served by excluding women who would compete with men for appointment as an administrator, falls far short of a compelling state interest when appraised in light of the interest of the class against which the statute discriminates, an interest in treatment by the law as full human personalities. If sex is a suspect classification, A state interest in avoiding a hearing cannot justify rank discrimination against a person solely on the ground that she is female. Laws which disable women from full participation in the political, business, and economic arenas are often characterized as protective and beneficial. Those same laws applied to racial or ethnic minorities would readily be recognized as invidious and impermissible. The pedestal upon which women have been placed has all too often, upon closer inspection, been revealed as a cage. On November 22, 1971, RBG lifted her head briefly from her reading. She was coming home by train, exhausted. Her eye fell on a man's newspaper. "High Court Outlaws Sex Discrimination," blared the front page of the New York Post. "Not exactly," she learned when she finally got her hands on the opinion. The court had ruled for Sally Reed, the first time the Supreme Court ever struck down a law that treated men and women unequally. It was a big deal, but the decision's reach was ambiguous. The court had laid down no broader rule. RBG's work was only just beginning. The birth of the WRP. Early mailings from the ACLU Women's Rights Project bore an unlikely stamp, the Playboy Bunny. At least one recipient was outraged at what turned out to be an in-kind donation from the magazine's foundation, a big ACLU donor. The feminist spin-off had begun on a shoestring. The WRP's first full-time employee was Brenda Feigen, a Harvard Law School graduate who had become a feminist activist. RBG's law students pitched in on the legwork. Still, RBG had big plans for the project, which she'd proposed to the ACLU board right after she won Reed. Along with Hugh Hefner, Irwin Griswold was a surprise, if unofficial, benefactor. After the Ginsburgs won the Moritz case at the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals, Solicitor General Griswold protested to the Supreme Court that the justices had to overrule them. Otherwise, hundreds of federal laws might be deemed unconstitutional. To prove his point, Griswold attached a computer-generated list, marked Appendix E, of all the laws and regulations that treated men and women differently. RBG swiftly realized what Appendix E really was: a hit list. The country had new laws banning discrimination in pay, employment, and education. But RBG knew that promises on paper wouldn't be enough. The distance to equal opportunity for women, in the face of the pervasive social, cultural, and legal roots of sex-based discrimination, remains considerable, she wrote in a prospectus in October 1972. The WRP would have three missions: public education, changing the law, and bringing cases to court, with the help of local ACLU affiliates across the country. Getting to equality would mean attacking on every front. Even if the Supreme Court made abortion legal, as it had just been asked to do, excessive restrictions on where abortions can be performed and medical benefits that can be applied to abortions would still have to be challenged. Other priorities, she wrote, would be the right to be voluntarily sterilized, something white middle-class women had been discouraged from doing by their doctors, and the right not to be involuntarily sterilized, something women of color and those considered mentally defective had been subject to. The project, wrote RBG, would tackle discrimination in education and training programs, as well as in the availability of mortgages, credit cards, loans, and home rentals, serve women in prison and in the military, and take on discriminatory confinement of girls in juvenile institutions because of sexual promiscuity. It would also go after institutions that discriminated against pregnant women. On May 14, 1973, the Supreme Court ruled on Frontiero v. Richardson, the first case RBG had argued before the court herself. Technically, she had won again. The justices had struck down the rule that treated Sharon Frontiero's work as less important to her family than a male service member's. And Justice William Brennan's opinion sounded like a win. Traditionally, such discrimination was rationalized by an attitude of romantic paternalism, which, in practical effect, put women not on a pedestal, but in a cage. He wrote, taking the words right from feminist lawyers' mouths. But there weren't 5 votes for a broader rule that would make most classifications by gender unconstitutional. Justice William Rehnquist was the lone dissenter. He told the Los Angeles Times, "My wife became resigned long ago to the idea that she married a male chauvinist pig, and my daughters never pay attention to anything I do." RBG learned a lesson that would stay with her for the rest of her life. She had been trying to teach the justices, and she wouldn't give up. But as she later acknowledged, one doesn't learn that lesson in a day. Generally, change in our society is incremental, I think. Real change, enduring change, happens one step at a time. She would have to be patient. She would have to be strategic, and maybe a little deaf. Her fellow feminists, on fire to transform the world, sometimes had to be persuaded to see things her way. "She insisted that we attempt to develop the law one step at a time," fellow ACLU lawyer Kathleen Paradis later said. "Present the court with the next logical step," she urged us, "and then the next, and then the next. Don't ask them to go too far too fast, or you'll lose what you might have won." She often said, "It's not time for that case." We usually followed her advice, and when we didn't, we invariably lost. Professor Ginsburg. RBG had begun to make a name for herself, even though she rarely sought the limelight. Ginsburg lacks the dash of a Gloria Steinem or the physical power of a Betty Friedan, wrote one student profiler. Her hair is usually tied in a ponytail. She speaks flatly, sometimes haltingly, but always precisely. She dresses conservatively. Among themselves, students call her Ruthie, as if she were someone's Jewish aunt. They are able to feel close to her without knowing her that well. RBG's students wrote in one course evaluation that she was brilliant and an excellent teacher, but also distant towards students, and quite a reserved person. By 1972, Columbia, which had let RBG go west to Rutgers 9 years earlier, finally saw her value. Her alma mater offered her the chance to become the law school's first tenured female professor, which she accepted with the understanding that she would spend part of her time at the ACLU. The New York Times said Columbia had scored a major coup. Its law school, to its undisguised glee, has just bid for and won a woman for the job of full professor. After all, according to the dean of the law school, Mrs. Ginsburg was actually qualified, apparently unlike all the other women they had refused to hire in 114 years of existence. "Just one point about which I am curious," RBG wrote the reporter when the piece came out. "Did the Times rule out Ms.?" RBG struck a surprisingly blunt note in the story. "The only confining thing for me is time. I'm not going to curtail my activities in any way to please them," she said, apparently referring to the faculty and administration. "I don't think I'll have any problem," she added a moment later. "People will be pleasant on the outside. Some of them may have reservations about what I'm doing, but I don't think they'll be expressed." Some people did have reservations, but the women at Columbia had been waiting for her. Almost immediately, they began contacting her to air grievances. Did RBG know that Columbia employees didn't have pregnancy coverage, and that women got lower pension benefits and lower pay? Well, now that she did, RBG helped file a class-action lawsuit with 100 named plaintiffs on behalf of female teachers and administrators at the university. They won. Did RBG know that the university was about to lay off more than 24 maids, all women, but not a single janitor? "We feel that our hope in preventing these firings lies in getting visible the support that we know exists for these women on this campus," wrote the activists on behalf of the maids, most of whom were women of color. RBG wrote to Columbia's president, calling the firing of the maids a grave and costly mistake, and urged him to avoid a course destined to turn into a federal case. She went to meetings to press the maids' case. She even got the ACLU and its New York branch involved, much to the indignation of Walter Gellhorn, the Columbia law professor who had helped RBG get her job at Rutgers. In a letter addressed to the gentlemen of the ACLU, Gellhorn accused the group of too quickly accusing the university of sex discrimination. RBG scrawled furiously in the letter's margins, "He misconceives nature of the case. No." The present episode, Gellhorn said, made him fear that the group had tended too much to begin screaming prematurely. The word mansplaining was unfortunately decades away from being invented, but in the end, no one, maid or janitor, was fired. RBG had tenure, but she didn't have to pick these battles, especially when some of her colleagues regarded her with suspicion for being there at all. There was a certain hostility to having her there, and the notion that she was only there because of the pressure the school faced to hire a woman, recalls Diane Zimmerman, a student at Columbia Law at the time, whom RBG mentored. RBG knew people said affirmative action like it was an insult. Others were of the view, she later wrote, that at last the days of negative action were over. The woman who didn't want an abortion. Women working. Brenda Feigen hung a bright yellow sign on the door with those words to mark WRP's territory at the new ACLU offices on 40th Street. RBG loved that sign. Women working at the WRP also meant the literal arrival of newborn babies, breastfed during the day by their attorney moms, tended by paid college students the rest of the time. Amid the chaos, RBG sat working methodically, her desk an oasis of calm. It was all a long way from getting pushed out of her job in Oklahoma, or scrambling for baggy clothes to keep her job at Rutgers. That was inside the ACLU. Outside it, making reproductive freedom a reality was a knotty mess. The problem the WRP faced in connecting pregnancy to their line of sex discrimination cases was this. Even if a man could take care of the kids and the elders, and a woman could join the Air Force and handle the family finances, only one of them could get pregnant and give birth. RBG and her team had to convince the justices that pregnancy, too, was a matter of equality, or inequality, and not just something special that women indulged in, off on their own. Even more radically, RBG wanted the Supreme Court to recognize that women would never be equal if they could not control their reproductive lives, whether they wanted to be pregnant or not. That meant the right to an abortion, and it meant the right to be free of discrimination for staying pregnant. Captain Susan Strzok, an Air Force nurse, never considered herself a feminist, but she also didn't behave like women were supposed to. For one thing, she had volunteered to be sent to Vietnam. In 1970, when she got pregnant, she refused to quit or get an abortion, the only options the military offered her. Ironically, abortion was still illegal almost everywhere in the United States, and it was a shock when, in 1969, radical feminists had held the first-ever abortion speak-out in a church basement in New York. Military bases were the exception. Strzok, raised Catholic, had enough sick leave saved up to give birth and give her baby up for adoption. So Strzok kept ignoring, then challenging, her discharge notices. She came to the ACLU for help. RBG jumped at the chance to build a gradual case that reproductive freedom was a condition of equality, beginning with a woman who didn't want an abortion. She couldn't help but notice the hypocrisy of a country that banned abortion except when it was convenient for the military. Other ACLU lawyers were involved in two more direct attacks on statewide abortion bans, Doe v. Bolton and Roe v. Wade, that were pending that very same term. Mindful of the arguments that had worked 7 years earlier when the court struck down a contraception ban in Griswold v. Connecticut, the Roe and Doe briefs claimed abortion fell under a right to privacy, not equality. RBG had other ideas, as she made clear in the brief for one of her favorite cases. From RBG's brief in Strzok v. Secretary of Defense. For additional commentary, please see the enhanced portion of this audiobook. The Air Force regulation directing immediate discharge of a woman officer upon determination that she is pregnant reflects arbitrary notions of a woman's place wholly at odds with contemporary legislative and judicial recognition that individual potential must not be restrained, nor equal opportunity limited, by law-sanctioned stereotypical prejudgments, operating on the basis of characteristics assumed to typify pregnant women, and, in total disregard of individual capacities and qualifications, the regulation violates the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution. The regulation singles out pregnancy, a physical condition unique to women involving a normally brief period of disability, as cause for immediate involuntary discharge. No other physical condition occasioning a period of temporary disability, whether affecting a man or a woman, is similarly treated. Heading the list of arbitrary barriers that have plagued women seeking equal opportunity is disadvantaged treatment based on their unique childbearing function. Until very recent years, jurists have regarded any discrimination in the treatment of pregnant women and mothers as benignly in their favor. But in fact, restrictive rules, and particularly discharge for pregnancy rules, operate as built-in headwinds that drastically curtail women's opportunities. Decisions of this court that span a century have contributed to this anomaly. Presumably well-meaning exaltation of women's unique role in bearing children has, in effect, restrained women from developing their individual talents and capacities, and has impelled them to accept a dependent, subordinate status in society. In addition to its reliance on a sex-based stereotype no less invidious than one racial or religious, the regulation invoked against petitioner operates as an unconstitutional infringement upon petitioner's right to privacy in the conduct of her personal life, and her right to free exercise of her religion. It encourages women officers not to bear children by prohibiting them from remaining in the Air Force if they do. Men in the Air Force, on the other hand, are not encouraged, on pain of discharge, to avoid the pleasures and responsibilities entailed in fathering children. A man serves in the Air Force with no unwarranted governmental intrusion into the matter of his sexual privacy or his decision whether to beget a child. The woman serves subject to regulation. Her pursuit of an Air Force career requires that she decide not to bear a child. Although petitioner, a Roman Catholic, does not seek privileged treatment based on her religious orientation, it should be stressed that the challenged regulation operates with particularly brutal force against women of her faith. Termination of pregnancy prior to the birth of a living child was not an option petitioner could choose. Thus, the regulation pitted her Air Force career against her right to privacy and autonomy in sexual matters, as well as her religious conscience. The conclusion is inescapable that the regulation directing Captain Strzok's discharge reflects blatant prejudice against women for a condition peculiar to their sex. If involuntary discharge of a woman solely on the ground of her pregnancy is not sex discrimination, nothing is. On December 4, 1972, the same day she filed her brief to the Supreme Court in the Strzok case, RBG got some bad news. Solicitor General Griswold had seen a loss coming and persuaded the Air Force to change its policy of automatically discharging pregnant women. The case was dismissed as moot, but RBG wasn't ready to let go. She asked Strzok, by then marooned at Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota, if there was any way to keep the case alive. Strzok dreamed of being a pilot. They had a big laugh over that one, Strzok and RBG. A female pilot? It was too impossible to even ask for. Do the deed, pay the price. 6 weeks after the Strzok case hit a wall, the Supreme Court handed down its twin decisions in Roe and Doe. Seven justices declared that the constitutional right to privacy is broad enough to encompass a woman's decision whether or not to terminate her pregnancy, and struck down all 50 states' abortion laws. In the years that followed, RBG made no bones about her dislike of Justice Harry Blackmun's opinion in the case. "It's not about the woman alone," she remarked disdainfully. "It's the woman in consultation with her doctor. So the view you get is the tall doctor and the little woman who needs him." Worse, the very sweep of the opinion violated RBG's go-slow policy, which she believed was the only way to change minds. The Supreme Court had chosen a path that led it away from where RBG had been hoping to coax the justices, and there seemed to be no turning back. If abortion was a private choice, would public insurance have to pay for it like any other medical procedure? No, said the Supreme Court.